from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this morning's opening hour, the Israeli offensive against Hamas in the Gaza Strip is now in its third week. In the Bay Area, protests, counter-protests, and calls for action have been intensifying. In the first half hour, we check in with Bay Area pro-Palestine activists, and in the second half, we talk with local supporters of Israel. What impact is the violence having on those in the Bay Area? Forum is next. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Protests both in support of and against Israel have taken place here in the San Francisco Bay Area since the conflict between the Israel government and Hamas turned increasingly militant with a regular barrage of rockets shot into Israel from Gaza by Hamas and the aerial bombardments of Gaza and the ground war into it by Israel. In this forum hour, we want to speak first with pro-Palestinian activists and then with supporters of Israel. And joining us in studio for this first half-hour segment is Lara Kiswani. She's executive director of AROC, the Arab Resource and Organizing Center. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the program. We also want to welcome Hatim Bazian, who is national chair of the American Muslims for Palestine. He's also senior lecturer of Near Eastern Studies and Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
And I should say by way of introduction that there was a major march from the Ferry Building. It marched up Market Street and to City Hall on Sunday, and a pro-Palestinian march, a march in sympathy with what's going on in Gaza. Lara Kiswani, do you feel this was really covered adequately by the media?
Not at all.
Tell us why.
Well, there are actually several media stations present at the demonstration, and it was a youth-led demonstration organized by many Arab youth and allies. So we had anticipated that the coverage would be reflective of that, but in fact, not much media coverage was done at all. If so, they covered the pro-Israeli demonstration that was happening 4 miles down, which was much smaller in scale.
They covered it, do you think, in a favorable way, as opposed to perhaps not covering adequately what was going on your side?
Well, given what's happening on the ground in Palestine and the level of the catastrophe and the impact on our community, the fact that over 6,000 people took to the streets of San Francisco and that wasn't covered on media in of itself is unfavorable to our community and was seen as, a really clear message that there is a bias in terms of media coverage, and this isn't, only localized Bay Area news. But our protest was covered by Al Jazeera, Arabic, international news, but wasn't even shown on local television stations.
So this has prompted, I imagine, or inspired much more use of social media, hasn't it?
Yeah, somewhat. But I mean, it's also about grassroots mobilizing and organizing. So while social media is definitely a tool, on social media, for instance, on the Facebook page, it said 2,000 people would show up. But we did have over 6,000 in the demonstration. There is an outrage, a very general sense of outrage that is felt by people, not only the Arab and Muslim community, but people of conscience in general. And so going out and just leafleting, letting people know that there is a demonstration, word of mouth has also been used in terms of our organizing strategy.
You had Jewish people there, didn't you?
Of course, anti-Zionist Jews. Yeah. We understand the issue of Palestine is central to, it's a social justice issue. So anybody who understands the critical use of U.S. money that aids Israel and enables the current catastrophe and massacre in Gaza is going to take to the streets and is outraged by this. Mm-hmm. So it's not just Arab and Muslim and allies. It's anti-Zionist Jews. We have other communities of color, young people, families. The streets were flooded by all types of people from the San Francisco Bay Area.
The signs I saw mostly said NUSA to Israel, but also genocide. Is this a genocide or is this a war? I mean, the word genocide is often used somewhat freely.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the numbers, and sometimes it's difficult to mask what's happening in numbers because right now the Palestinians are so dehumanized that we're nameless and faceless people. But ultimately, there's an average of one child dying each hour in the last 10 days. We've had over 700 people killed in Gaza. And when we talk about Gaza, people have to understand we're talking about an open-air prison that's locked out on all sides, being bombarded on the ground and by air. And the people people. Hospitals are being demolished. Homes are being demolished. Over 118,000 people have been displaced. This is nothing but a massacre and a genocide. And had it only started 10 days ago, perhaps you could question this. But the very fact that Gaza has been occupied since 1967, Palestine has been occupied since 1948. We've had this is an ongoing genocide since 1948. And all that we see on the ground, what we're seeing is this is an attack on the Palestinian people and really an attack on all Palestinian people and an attempt to destroy Palestine in every shape, way, or form.
And the missiles that are coming from Gaza and not necessarily even monitored in terms of whom they might hit, though the Iron Dome is obviously keeping them from hitting civilians, but not necessarily aimed at any specific targets or pinpointed, as John Kerry would call it.
Sure. I mean, there's definitely rockets being fired from Gaza, and the rockets would stop if the occupation stopped and the attacks by Israel stopped. There was a ceasefire since November 2012, and the person or the entity that actually not obey that ceasefire was Israel. So the facts speak for themselves. At the end of the day, Israel attacked Palestine. In the last 8 years, there have been 8 bombardments of Gaza by the state of Israel. It's not the rockets that are creating that environment. It's the siege of Gaza, the blockade, the humanitarian needs on the ground. And these are the demands of the people on the ground. All they're asking for, and Hamas has said this time and time again, they're asking for fuel, they're asking for electricity and food. These are very basic humanitarian needs.
And again, Lara Kiswani is the executive director of AROC, the Arab Resource and Organizing Center. Hatem Bazian is National Chair of American Muslims for Palestine and Senior Lecturer of Near Eastern Studies and Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley. Just look at the situation from the possibility of a ceasefire with you, Hatem Bazian. I mean, the last time it was worked out largely by Mohamed Morsi, who has had good connections to the Muslim Brotherhood, to put it mildly, Hamas. And represented them and was part of the Muslim Brotherhood. What I'm wondering is, can a ceasefire be brokered now under this present Egyptian government, or for that matter under John Kerry, because there's a lot of hostility in Palestine against those sources?
Well, it seems that Israel have launched this attack on Gaza knowing that the strategic landscape in the region is highly fragmented, that it has a strong alliance with the Sisi. If anything, Israel have assisted the Sisi in his post-coup effort, and I think they also have extended some lobbying effort on his behalf in the U.S., to get the U.S. to actually stand by him and support him.
So there's immense distrust for the U.S. as a broker or Egypt as a broker.
Absolutely. Then also broadly speaking, the Gulf states are preoccupied with the war in Iraq and the war in Syria, with their focus being directed to Iran and the possible confrontation and containment of Iran. So that also is another layer of fragmentation. The ability of the United States to broker a ceasefire is highly suspect in the sense that, yes, 2 days ago you have the Senate voting 100-1 in support of Israel, as well as extending further financial support, $631 million, to bolster Israel's security and provide further Iron Dome support. So I don't see any really fundamental shifts that would motivate the participants in the region, whether it's Israel or Egypt, to come to bring this to an end. The only possibility if Israel itself, and there are some discussions in the Israeli press today, that Israel should unilaterally declare a ceasefire and as such would not be subject to negotiating an end to the siege or giving to any of the basic demands that the Palestinians have put forth, which is ending the siege, which is in violation of the 4 Geneva Convention, international law, and providing the needed humanitarian support. Now, we need to know that Gaza is an occupied territory. Israel is responsible for everything that the Palestinians need, including their life and safety under occupation. We have an oddity in this sense that we have an occupation where the occupied population as well as the world community are being responsible to pay for it. And I think that needs to change fundamentally.
But the argument that you hear that when when the Israelis left and Palestinians elected Hamas in Gaza, there could have been a partnership. In fact, one could even argue that to some extent with the West Bank and under Abu Mazen, there is a kind of partnership with Israel. At least there's amity. There's some accord, and there's not this kind of militancy. But that by electing Hamas, essentially the Palestinians forfeited that right.
Well, my response is that Israel did have a partner in Yasser Arafat. He did sign the peace treaty in 1992, the Oslo. I'm a very critical of the Oslo agreement and how it came about. But if there is a relationship, I would say it's a domestic abuse relationship between Israel and the Palestinians, where the Palestinians are constantly being punished by Israel in the West Bank. There's an increasing expansion of this building of settlements. As we know, at the time of the signing of the Oslo Agreement, the settler and settlement activity was about 100,000 to 180,000. Now we're actually reaching about 600,000. So there was an expansion of the settlement's footprint, and successive Israeli government have used the peace process in essence to build facts on the ground and use the peace process as a way to have an open-ended occupation and open-ended expansion of their footprint over the Palestinians.
But the argument that you hear, I'm sure, is that Hamas wants the destruction of the State of Israel, so there's a very different relationship with Hamas than there is with Abu Mazen and West Bank. I mean, it's very divided. In fact, Israel was obviously concerned about the unity between these two because it sees Hamas as being its enemy.
Well, my response is constantly that Israel's things have a very long-term strategic plan, and their strategic plan is not to give up the occupied territories. And we hear it from time and time again from all the political leadership. I think Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister, wants to expel all the Palestinians. He actually is committed to transfer. Netanyahu,
compared to him, Netanyahu is almost a progressive.
Yeah, and Netanyahu himself, I don't think he has the capacity actually to go ahead and end the occupation and accept a two-state solution, which is a foregone conclusion at this particular time.
All right, this particular time, I want to invite listeners to join us. If you would like to join us, you can do so now. This is a segment that's only going up to the half hour, so if you have something you'd like to contribute to the conversation or a question or a comment, feel free to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Before I go to callers and emailers here, I just want to get a sense from each of you, if I can, about the human side of this. And let me begin, Hatem Bazian, with you, because I know that you have family in Nablus in Jerusalem, and there are people here in the Bay Area who are obviously being affected because of what's going on in Gaza. Give us a sense.
Well, we have a large Palestinian as well as Arab and Muslim community in the Bay Area, and a number of families have lost family members in Gaza. I know that the Jumaa family have lost 27 members. Abu Sneni family have lost 7 members. Al-Qarra family has lost 3 members. Also, the youth that was burned to death, Abu Khdeir, he has actually a direct family members both in here and in Sacramento who held accepting condolences from the community member, and that is taking place across the Bay Area, where people who are listening, receiving messages on Twitter, on Facebook, on WhatsApp, just to get the sense of what is taking place, and they're hearing about the loss of their family members on a regular basis. So you're dealing with a community that's almost not sleeping 24/7 because the calamity that is befalling the civilian population is unbelievable. And there's actually all the doors are locked. So medicine is not coming in, support is not coming in. So even if you want, as a family member, that you have suffered a loss, even a phone call is very difficult. To actually send some support is very difficult on a human level.
Let me go to Lara on this, too. Lara Kiswani is here with us in studio, the executive director of AROC, the Arab Resource and Organizing Center. I've been reading, you know, that children are getting the brunt of this. The Israelis say, well, a lot of this is pinpointed, a lot of it's targeted, a lot of it is resulting in civilian casualties because missiles are being put behind schools and in schools and mosques and so forth and so on. But let's talk about just the human impact of this.
I mean, the families that Hatem named are real families here in the Bay Area. These are people that in of themselves are refugees from Palestine. And when we talk about the days of mourning and the condolences that Hatem was also mentioning, you have to imagine that there are people here in the Bay Area who've lived most of their lives here, talking every other day to folks in Palestine and communicating with their family members, learning about what's happening on the ground, because this occupation has been escalating. And for instance, the family that lost 30 people now, the numbers have gone up to 30, the Abu Jameh family, who now has, you know, on Friday in their home in San Jose, they're allowing anybody in the Bay Area to come express their condolences because they really do want to be a part of a community and enable people to provide people the opportunity to really be with them in their healing process. But this isn't just, you know, any other family. This is 30 people of one family that were massacred in Gaza.
It's an extended family or
this is a first cousin. These are the first cousins of this man in San Jose. And many of his other cousins are members of AIROC. These are people we know very close. There isn't one Palestinian person in all the United States, I would say not one Palestinian person in the entire world, that hasn't been touched immediately or indirectly by what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank. I was talking to my sister today, who works in Jenin at the Freedom Theater with young people, using theater as a medium to express themselves and as a way of cultural empowerment and leadership development for youth. These people have also gone through a massacre of themselves years ago in the Jenin refugee camp. And this internalized trauma is something that she deals with every day and tries to address through different theater and cultural aspects. Now, what they're seeing is a new form of trauma that's being inflicted on them by what's happening in Gaza. And the years of loss that this is going to take, the impact this is going to have on generations. What we're seeing in Gaza today, yes, we can go over the numbers. Over 700 people have been killed, over 100 children, a child an hour. But really what that means, this is generations of trauma. Generations of trauma of Palestinians that are going to have to undergo all types of healing processes while undergoing colonialism. So really at the heart of this, we have to understand that the impact of occupation is long-lasting. And the only real way to address this is to end the injustice in of itself.
All right. I want to read a comment from a listener who wrote on our website. David, being the listener, general comment, the dichotomy of pro-Israel versus pro-Palestine is the dominant narrative of the conflict, but radicals on both sides who are driving the current round of warfare seem more alike than different. Both are driven by rabid racism and are willing to use violent means to press for change. Neither take into account the long-term consequences of that violence, nor do they have realistic solutions that respect their counterparts. The real dichotomy is between moderates and radicals. Only when moderates win on both sides will there be peace. That's according to one of our listeners. Another listener says, question directed to the panelists that will highlight the core issue, as far as I'm concerned, underlying today's discussion. This is Mike in San Rafael. It says, do you support peace between the Jewish state of Israel and a future Arab state of Palestine?
I mean, can I just say that if people want to understand the long-term impact of Palestinians, the long-term impact of occupation, the long-term impact of what's happening on the ground today, then speak to a Palestinian. I am a receiving end of that long-term impact. I can't live in Palestine. My mother was never able to visit Palestine. My grandma was expelled by foot from Palestine. I am, in of itself, an embodiment of that long-term impact. So if anyone understands it, it's us here who have also been living the life of people in diaspora. And furthermore, in terms of racism, I'll be the first person to stand against racism. AIROC takes a very clear position against all forms of discrimination and injustice.
But let me ask you about the question specifically. Do you support peace, the listener wants to know, between the Jewish state of Israel and a future Arab state of Palestine?
I don't believe in a Jewish-only state. I don't believe in exclusionary state, period. I believe in a state for all people.
And another listener has a question for you specifically, Lara, before I go to calls. Your organization regularly sponsors demonstrations that feature chants of River to the Sea, and We Support the Intifada. It's a clear call for the destruction of Israel as a nation state of the Jewish people, and it's the main reason that moderate peace activists in the Bay Area no longer participate in your events. Do you support a Jewish state of Israel living side by side and in peace with an Arab state? There it is again. But this listener wants to know, if not, why not?
I don't support an apartheid state. I don't support a state for only one type of people. Ultimately, what we believe in is one state for all people. Democracy should be across all spectrums. It shouldn't be for Jewish people only. A Jewish-only state is in of itself a racist state, and that has proven itself time and time again. The apartheid state of Israel is an apartheid state. It is not a democracy. Ultimately, what we stand for is freedom for all people and liberation for all people. So we say River to the Sea. We're talking about ending occupation.
Palestinians are in the Knesset, though. Palestinians are citizens who can vote.
Well, I think the phrasing of the question is a problem, because it sets it up as a yes and no question. Mm-hmm. And in essence, here the Palestinians who've been expelled from their homes, completely their cultural society has been demolished. 8 urban centers in 1948 been completely demolished, 480 villages. And yet the question is phrased as if we are the aggressors on constituting a state that has been systematically engaged in the dispossession of the Palestinians. I think the question should be posed the other way. What is the borders of Israel as we know it? What is the limits of the settlements? What is the Israeli prime minister's view on actually ending the occupation? What is the foreign minister's position on the rights of the Palestinians, both inside Palestine and outside? What is the Israeli government position on the right of return? So I think posing the question to the Palestinians implies that the Palestinians are somewhat anti-Semitic and therefore are unable to live with the Jews. And I think the other way is the core issue, which is that Israel has not been able to live with the Palestinians, and it wants the best Palestinian for them is an expelled, jailed, or killed Palestinian.
Let us hold it there because we do want to bring in some calls. And Scott, you're first up here. Good morning.
Hi. My question and comment is as follows. There's a very robust debate within the Jewish community and within Israel itself, frankly, about the Israeli government's actions. And I don't hear that similar debate within the Palestinian Arab community. And I was just wondering, is that community really so monolithic in its support of Hamas and their actions?
Well, I think to phrase it as a Hamas issue is also a problem. All the Palestinian factions are all committed to resisting the occupation and calling for an end. We're just completely wanting an end, a fundamental end to the process that has continuously dispossessed the Palestinians. We're losing more of our land under the peace process than before. We don't want another political delegation, diplomatic delegation coming from the U.S. masquerading as honest brokers. The only thing they're brokering is Palestinian land away, political rights away, and not wanting freedom, dignity for the Palestinians.
You've just revealed why you have this rather strong concern about Oslo or adverse feelings about Oslo. But let me bring another caller on, which you alluded to earlier. And that's Mickey. Good morning, Mickey. You're on.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm calling from Berkeley. I want to say that at some point, similar to what the caller just said, the Palestinian community has a responsibility to look at themselves and what they're doing for their own community. Hamas has dedicated a lot, millions and millions of dollars and time and resources to building these death tunnels rather than spending those resources on schools and gyms and things that would benefit their own children and their own community. And at some point, there has to be an internal discussion within that community to strengthen its own community and take responsibility. I also want to say that as much as your guest has said she is an example of someone who has been affected by, you know, being in diaspora, I am originally from Israel, dual citizen, and when you're there, you realize that if anyone there goes to the army, everyone there goes to the army. As soon as a son is born, you have that sense that at some point they may go fight in the army. The Israelis take that very seriously. They do not want to have their people killed. And also, I think the other issue is that the Jewish state is not going anywhere. So at some point, there has to be a meaningful discussion about how to make it work for both sides. I really think that if there was some progress in the Palestinian community devoting its resources to things like schools and community, they would get that.
All right, Mickey, let me take that point because we're in a time crunch here. What about the sense of using resources to build tunnels or to get rockets as opposed to Hatem Bazan, as opposed to, you know, what she's saying, infrastructure, schools?
Wait, so I would have to say, why do we need tunnels? There wouldn't be tunnels if there wasn't a blockade and a siege to begin with, first and foremost. So we're not putting money into tunnels because we can't put money into other resources. We're putting money into tunnels because we need to get those resources first and foremost. And ultimately, the other reason why Israel...
Tunnels are used for militant purposes too, though.
They should be used for resistance as well when you are occupied and living under a blockade. And the very fact that every Israeli person has to be in the military, I would argue that it's not because you want to defend yourself. Every Israeli person has to be in the military to continue the displacement and occupation of Palestine.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Alara Kiswani. Thank you, and Bazian. And when we return, we'll hear from some Israel supporters. You stay where you are. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We just heard from a couple of local activists on the Gaza conflict on the Palestinian side, and now we're going to hear from some supporters and activists on the Jewish side. With us in studio is Rabbi Menachem Creditor. He's a rabbi at Congregation Nativo Shalom in Berkeley and author of a book called Peace in Our Cities, Rabbis Against Gun Violence. He's also on the Executive Council for the Rabbinical Assembly and a trustee of the American Jewish World Service. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael.
Good to have you. Also good to have Mark Schickman here with us, who chairs the Middle East Strategy and is past president of the JCRC, the Jewish Community Relations Council. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Let me begin, Mark Schickman, with you, because I know you feel, at least so you've expressed, there's real unanimity in the Jewish community behind Israel on this, but we just heard about a lot of supporters who are anti-Zionist who are out there protesting with Palestinians. Address that?
Yeah, the numbers on this one have been very different from the other conflicts, because it's really so clear that if the rockets stopped from Gaza, this conflict would be over. And so certainly there's going to be a handful of people. There was a program at Temple Emmanuel on Sunday with 1,000 people, and there were 5 members of our community out of that 1,000 who expressed an opposite view. But among most of us in the Bay Area, who are liberal on most every issue and who are committed to social cause issues, and sometimes there's conflict about what Israel is doing. But given the circumstances here, given Israel accepting ceasefires and making clear that as soon as the rockets stop, this whole incursion stops, there's more unanimity on this one than there has ever been before.
You say that things will cease if the rockets stop, but we just heard from pro-Palestinian activists that maybe because they were asked questions about would you accept a Jewish state, and still Hamas is opposed to a Jewish state, still the occupations go on. In other words, the essential problems don't go away with just rocket stopping. You have a ceasefire, and it's going to be temporary, if anything.
Well, you heard the term occupation. I thought it was interesting that the term was the 1948 occupation, and that the rockets will stop if we have an end to the 1948 occupation, which is to say when Israel disappears. So it is true that one basic premise has got to be that you can have a Jewish state and a Palestinian state living side by side in peace. And to say, one opposes a Jewish state, one should have a state without religion. You know, first say that to the 22 Muslim nations in the region. And if you pick the only Jewish state in the region and say, you know, a religious entity is bad, so let's start with you. It's quite clear that you're really not saying anything other than you don't want a Jewish entity. So you're right, Michael, that it does require an acceptance, as Israel has accepted a Palestinian state. It does require that acceptance that the Palestinian Authority has given. Hamas is not. And I think that's why it was really telling that State Department officials yesterday said that after there's a ceasefire, what then needs to happen is, in diplomatic means, the people who reject the two-state solution need to be demilitarized and allow the people of Gaza to accept concrete that comes in to build homes and schools and not to build tunnels, and have money that comes in to really provide for the medicine and the food that you heard about, as opposed to paying people to suicide bomb.
Well, Rabbi Creditor, you wrote a piece in the Huffington Post. Essentially, you said, I'm done apologizing for Israel. I'm a hard left progressive in favor. In fact, Peter Beinart did a whole piece about so-called Jewish liberals, progressives, whatever word is preferable, being diluted somehow from their support of Israel because of supporting same-sex marriage or supporting other social causes that they are in favor of, reproductive rights, illegal immigrants, so-called, or undocumented immigrants. But when you say you're done apologizing for Israel, does that include, for example, the settlements?
Well, I think it's important to differentiate between what a settlement is and what a Jewish neighborhood is. But the truth is, having just returned from Israel, when I say I'm done apologizing for Israel, what I mean to say is that I watched missiles fly not only at these theoretical family members of mine with whom I have deep and strong ties. I saw missiles over my own head and was in bunkers at the foreign ministry watching Iron Dome protect lives. And when I, especially in Berkeley in the Bay Area, having now been here for 7 years, when I speak that heart, when I speak as a Zionist, as a human rights activist and a Zionist, some of my partners on other human rights issues, progressive issues, don't understand me anymore because suddenly I must have lost my moorings. I'm proud of the State of Israel. I'm proud of the restraint that it's showing in the face of enormous threat. I also feel enormous pain for the casualties in Gaza. I do not hear anyone in Gaza. I do not hear any of the pro-Palestinian activists asking me if I believe in two states. I believe in two states. I believe in the right of self-determination for the Palestinian people as well. My existence as a people, our existence as a people in Israel, has caused enormous dislocation for Palestinians. But that is our existence. And so I can't apologize for my existence. It was not an occupation. It is not an expulsion. The disaster is being caused by Hamas. Were the missiles not to be flying into my family, where my almost brother-in-law works on the 41st floor on a tower in Tel Aviv, cannot make it to a shelter, and there was a siren about 2 minutes ago.
There was also in your article mentioning of the fact that the Palestinians, at least in Gaza, the Hamas Palestinians, or those who we heard the phrasing were under the occupation. Mark Schickman makes a distinction between the 48 occupation and what is going on in Gaza. But you essentially pointed out there was celebration of the death of those three Jewish teens, which was in some respects a catalyst. Whether Hamas was directly responsible or not is at this point still somewhat cloudy. But it was like when the Scuds came from Iraq, there was celebration. And your point was celebration of Palestinians isn't necessarily being ballyhooed in Israel. But to a great extent, of course, a Palestinian boy was set afire. There has been somebody who was just transferred, in fact, from CNN, who was a correspondent, as you may be aware, transferred to Russia because there was cheering going on. So, I mean, it's on both sides, isn't it, really?
No, I don't think the equivalence is a fair analysis. I think it's important to point out that Israel and the entire Jewish world condemned the murder of the Palestinian teenager, Mohammed Abu Khdeir.
Well, they also made arrests, too.
They made arrests immediately. The Jewish world condemns that action. I think it's important for us to work when we have the moment to breathe as a Jewish people, as an Israel, as a state of Israel, to work on perfecting the parts of us that, just like any group, has extreme elements, sometimes because that's how it goes and that's not a neutral statement. When you're a normal state, when you're a normal people, you have extremists. But Israel has demonstrated time and time again that it does not tolerate its own internal extremism. The response to the kidnapping and the murder of Ayal and Gilad and Naftali, teenagers who were doing nothing but trying to get home from school, and the celebration of their murder immediately by their kidnappers and then by Palestinian society at large, mocking the emblem of the World Cup to show a celebration salute of three Jewish teenagers kidnapped and murdered. The difference is crucial to point out. I do not castigate Palestinian society, but I do absolutely point a finger at Hamas. And in 2005, when Israel unilaterally withdrew from Gaza and Hamas won a majority of the electoral seats and then staged a coup and kicked out Fatah, the more moderate group, or at least supposedly moderate group of Palestinian leaders, it prompted...
And a far more corrupt group, let us add, too.
Certainly. It prompted what could not be seen as an equivalence. Hamas is determined by its charter to destroy Israel, and Israel doesn't want to be destroyed. I don't want my family to be murdered.
Is this what you're presenting as the Israeli side? Is this being fairly essentially presented in the media, in your judgment?
I think the important thing is not to look at how the media is presenting things, although I think there's fault on both sides. I think when we look to headlines to determine our values, I think we're in enormous, enormous trouble. I think it's important to point out things that are not being reported at all, such as the tons and tons of food and diesel and medical goods that are going into Gaza. Despite the situation, in the last 10 days, there have been 1,278 tons of food sent in, 3 million liters of diesel sent into Gaza, including to the UN, and a hospital has been set up on the Erez crossing. And so that it's not reported at all, and the misrepresentation of the tunnels, built with 800,000 tons of cement that were let into Gaza by Israel after the 2010 opening of the blockade so that Gaza could build an infrastructure for its citizenship. So on the one hand, yes, there's a media slant, but there's always a media slant on every side. What's important is to say it's time to stop with not including the humanity of the other.
Let me read some emails. Robert from Oakley says, how many Israelis have been killed by Hamas missiles, and how does this compare to the dead in Gaza in this current incursion? There is this kind of proportionality, and you hear it, I think you do hear it even from the media, with the number of those killed in Gaza as opposed to the number of Israelis because of the Iron Dome that are being killed. And so the assumption is this is disproportionate.
You do hear that in the media, and I don't think that it's fair. If one of these missiles got through Iron Dome, which is only 90% effective, it's, you know, the term Iron Dome, I think, has more security than actually exists. If one of those missiles hit a school and killed 20 children in a school, I wouldn't feel any better about what's going on. I don't think that it would change the morality of this situation. It wouldn't change the circumstance that that Israel is dropping leaflets and is making phone calls and is trying to warn civilians to get out of the buildings and out of the streets where they are. And they do have places to go to other spots and other streets. Whereas, you look at what has happened in Syria next door, and you see the numbers that would occur if you have a military that's actually trying to cause civilian deaths or is not being sensitive towards civilian deaths. So every single death in Gaza is a tragedy that should not be happening. And the fact that Hamas is putting rockets in schools, rockets in hospitals, embedding in civilian territory, it just grabs at not only my soul but of everybody in Israel. And
I think some might say that the attention – you mentioned Syria. The attention on Israel is disproportionate given the kind of civilian casualties and deaths that have been rampant in Syria as far as the media is concerned. But I want to go to another listener named Sean who writes, please ask your guests who support Israel what other country in the world would be allowed to have 75% of their killings be civilians. This is not for dispute. It's a United Nations number. How do terrorists acting among civilians make the civilians' lives forfeit in the eyes of the IDF? And 75% was actually reported by the New York Times from the UN 3 days ago and pertaining to the current conflict.
It doesn't make it forfeit, but what is Israel supposed to do if Hamas is putting missiles and putting missile launchers in hospitals and schools? Is it supposed to basically say, okay, you win under that circumstance, we'll accept these rockets coming in? So it does what it can by warning people. But for the entire country of Israel, maybe that's a bit of an overstatement, for 75% of Israel to be living under a constant threat of rocket attack, it has to do something about it. And, you know, the real answer is for the people of Gaza to say to Hamas, this is unacceptable. You cannot use our apartments as launching pads.
Rabbi, let me go to another web comment and get your response to this. This is a listener who writes, excuse me, if Israel genuinely wants to live in peace with its neighbors, then why does its present government continue to build illegal settlements in the West Bank? And how is it in America's interest to continue to give Israel billions of dollars of unrestricted economic and military aid to create, quoting this listener here, an apartheid state in the occupied territories?
I reject the framing of the question. Israel does want peace. That was its founding statement. That is its continuous stance. Every government of Israel, extremist or not, you look at Menachem Begin, who was certainly not a moderate in his youth or in his beginning political career, and forged a peace treaty with Egypt. If that doesn't demonstrate our willingness as a people to forge peace with our neighbors, nothing does.
That had
does.
A lot to do with Anwar Sadat, though. And
yes, to have a willing partner on the other side makes an enormous difference. And to have a credible partner for peace makes an enormous difference. I would say that for those who are looking at Israeli building, to differentiate between what are neighborhoods, to be there on the ground, to go and see what is called a settlement in the world media, I think is a very important point. In addition to which, the idea of unrestricted funding from America, I think it's very important to see that foreign aid for humanitarian purposes and for defense is very different than the way it's characterized by the critics of Israel. And I also think it's important to say that Israeli society has been battered and battered. To hear the speakers before me use the term domestic abuse, to describe their relationship with Israel, I would say that the very same words are being used right now by Israeli society after decades, 66 years plus of trauma up and down, west and east. And I think, to be honest, the 2005 unilateral withdrawal from Gaza was, from a pastoral perspective, an unnegotiated divorce.
And let me read another listener comment.
Yeah.
It kind of dovetails with what you're saying here, but this again is critical from a listener who writes, "It's clear to me that the present government of Israel does not want a two-state solution or peace with the Palestinians. Despite words to the contrary to placate the international community in general, and the U.S. in particular, Israel's actions indicate an ethnic cleansing campaign, the goal being to eradicate the Palestinian people from what had been Palestine. What actions by Israel can the Israeli activists on the panel point to which would demonstrate a legitimate support of an independent, viable, and free Palestinian state?"
Well, for one, the Y Accords that both the United States government and Israel offered would put 97% of the pre-1967 West Bank in Palestinian hands, and that 3% would have been compensated for by creating a land bridge between Gaza and the West Bank so that you would have a contiguous Palestinian state. So, you know, the proof of it is that Israel offered it and the American government pushed it. And at the very end, Arafat was not able to say yes to it because of the extremist radicals in his own camp. So that's number one. And the second thing, you know, the concepts of apartheid and the concepts of ethnic cleansing, as you pointed out, look at the countries in the area and see the levels of death that occurs if you're trying to accomplish an ethnic cleansing, and compare it to what's happening when, you know, again, any death in Gaza is you know to be abhorred and is to be really taken to heart. When you look at that, those numbers, if there were an ethnic cleansing attempt, there'd be 10 times, 20 times, 30 times as many deaths. It is a gross, unfair, an obnoxious statement, which is the furthest thing from the truth.
And speaking of numbers and truth, I just want to get a couple of emails and tweets on the air here, and then we'll go to your calls. Joe from Santa Clara says, if San Francisco had limited water, sewage, electricity, with 95% of the people unemployed, and by the way, that's simply a wrong figure. I think it was reported in Newsweek that there's a 41% unemployment in Gaza. But anyway, he says, because the city was under siege for years with its citizens not being able to leave for any reason, including getting health care and education, then I would probably revolt against my oppressors also. Do these pro-Israeli speakers support ending the siege? Rabbi?
The facts on the ground are simply not as they're being presented. Goods and education and humanitarian efforts are being provided not only by Israel but by the UN with Israel's support. And so the idea that the entire populace of Gaza is being held under siege by Israel is a misrepresentation of Hamas.
Weren't there attempts initially after Israel left Gaza to have a partnership and to sink money into Gaza that would...
Certainly. The economic foundation for a Gazan society, a civil society with industry, were set up by Israel, including many thousands of greenhouses.
So then what? Hamas was elected and
Hamas burned it. When Israel withdrew, Hamas burned the business infrastructure that Israelis had been torn from by Israel.
I want to go to our callers. Let me begin, Colin, with you. Thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Good morning. Secretary of State Kerry tweeted his condolences to the family of Max Steinberg, a 24-year-old Israeli-American who was killed as a volunteer for the Israeli Defense Forces. Seems to me there's a little bit of a double standard in Kerry expressing his gratitude for a Jewish American who goes abroad to fight for a foreign power, while at the same time, as Steinberg had been a Muslim American, his death would have not have been celebrated, and in fact, he would have been condemned by Kerry and most of our political establishment as a terrorist.
I think the rabbi wants to respond to your remarks, Rabbi.
I think it's an important point. It is absolutely essential to mourn together. And when Mohammed Abu Khdir was murdered by a terrorist as identified by Israel, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Israelis came to pay their condolences. And so on the human level, it is important to say that we all grieve with every death. It is an obscenity before God that anyone dies needlessly.
There's not going to be, at this point, though, likely, I'll just ask the two of you to sort of assess a ceasefire because of Kerry being obviously not trusted by the Hamas side, if you will, and al-Sisi not being trusted. If Morsi were still in power, there would have been a possibility maybe for a ceasefire. But at this point, it seems pretty unlikely, doesn't it?
It's going to take the people of Gaza to say that their economic best interests, the lives of their children, are best served by dealing with this issue on a diplomatic basis and not saying these rockets are going to fly as long as the 1948 occupation, in other words, the existence of the State of Israel, continues. I think it takes that, and I think that a difference this time around is that the international community is calling for a demilitarization. That's what it takes. Is it easy to do? Clearly not. But I look to the possible, and that I think is a concept that's being floated now that the State Department has taken that might be an answer.
Well, when the caller brings up Secretary of State Kerry's double standard, I'm looking at a tweet from a listener named Sami who says, Michael, everyone should remember that a month before the three settlers were killed in the West Bank, two Palestinian teenagers were killed on camera, including CNN's by Israeli soldiers. We didn't see any reaction from the world vis-a-vis the three settlers. I have that on the record. We'll go to another caller. Jack, you're on. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, Michael. Your guests, it's kind of perplexing to listen to them. Israel has often boasted that they have intelligence of every occupant and building in Gaza, but the slaughter and mayhem would suggest that IDF is deliberately targeting civilians. Now, where are there terrorists lurking in sewage plants and water treatment plants? Perhaps your guests could explain that.
Mark Schickman.
I think, again, if you look at the numbers, you don't see indiscriminate killing. And what you do see is homes that are fronts for tunnels tunneling into Israel, where commandos are coming out with equipment that's designed to wipe out a moshav on the other side of the border. So if you are...
But as pointed out by the Palestinian guests in the last hour, the tunnels are also used to bring things in that are needed. They're being essentially kept out of Palestine.
Well, they actually pointed out that the tunnels are being used to bring in materials that are needed for the resistance was
well, that's true, but also food supplies and health care and so forth.
The idea that those tunnels have been built to support the Gazan societies being built is an absolute abhorrence to human rights. People on the ground.
Are they being used solely for military purposes, Rabbi?
I'm not in the tunnels, but the construction of the tunnels, as has been documented by the stockpiles of weapons in them and the assaults that have been intercepted when the terrorists emerge from them and the misusing of building materials, 800,000 tons of cement meant for building schools and hospitals and homes. The misuse of that is a crime against the Palestinian people being perpetrated by Hamas.
All right. I want to get as many calls on as I can, and we go next to you. David, thanks for waiting. You join us, please.
Yeah, I was actually going to raise the possibility of peacetime economics, but before I did, maybe I get a clarification and it would help the question. One of your guests a minute ago said something about I think his exact phrase was the trade that we provide, the goods provided by Israel. That's his exact phrase. So if I understand right, Gaza is surrounded by a wall, and if I remember right, it's like, 16 feet tall, so you can't get in or out. I mean, this is a creepy place, right? And it's 50 miles or 80 miles or some outrageous amount of land area. And so all trade is dominated by Israel, all trade. And smuggling missiles in, smuggling concrete in, anything, is pretty odd. And so I'm just wondering if he could clarify, is Gaza's entire commercial sector dominated by Israel? And the other, the original question was, Saudi Arabia and Iran are now doing trade talks. Now, that's an enmity that's gone on for since Jimmy Carter's day, long before that. In fact, this Saudi Prince Bandar is the one that screwed up trade. And now that he's getting busted, they're actually looking at, wait a minute, did we get tricked for 40 years into not trading with each other? And we could have been having happy commerce instead of having a crazy military paranoia economy. So if
David, I think I know where you're going with this. Common interests and common trade, mutual possibility for compact on those levels. I think perhaps, Rabbi, you were alluding to this earlier when you said that was at least, from your perspective, Israel's intention initially.
I'm a little bit confused by the question, to be honest, but I think...
Well, I'm extrapolating from it. I think what he's asking, or what he's maybe stating more than asking in some ways, is the fact that there could be amity if there's mutual economic interest.
That would be great.
Amen. That's all I have to say to that. Amen.
And by the way, in terms of the description of the blockade, Egypt controls the borders on the south, and but for the fact that Hamas kicked out the Palestinian Authority, those borders would be open. And somehow there are 20,000 rockets, including rockets that have come in from Syria and Iran in Gaza. So the concept that there's a 10-foot fence all around that is able to keep something out, how did 20,000 rockets get in there?
Yeah, that fence is not keeping the rockets out if there is a 10-foot fence. Here's a listener who writes, there are two key factors that, if understood, could bring progress for the Palestinians. The state of Israel is not going to go away. To drive to another solution will continue to be futile. A two-state solution is the only possible outcome for a peaceful end. For the Israelis, it is disingenuous to say that there was not an expulsion, taking a property or occupation with the creation of the state of Israel. Come to terms with this. Stop continuing to take land by building settlements and make overtures for reparation. Another listener says, I'm hearing very little challenge to the Zionist guests about their position on the settlements. Clearly, they have been trained to keep the focus on the threat to Israel whenever the subject comes up and have not given a sufficient justification for land grabs.
The answer to that is that every Israeli plan has noted that more than 80% of the people living in settlements are within about, you know, the contiguous to the border. 80% of the settlements themselves would be dismantled under any peace plan. So I don't think there's any question that the Israeli peace plans include getting rid of many of the settlements as Israel walked away from settlements in Gaza in 2005.
We're going to have to leave it there. Mark Schickman from the Jewish Community Relations Council, thank you for being with us. And Rabbi Menachem Krediter from Congregation Nativo Shalom in Berkeley. His book is Peace in Our Cities, Rabbis Against Gun Violence. Thank you for being with us for this hour. For another hour ahead, we're going to talk with novelist, essayist William Volman. Be here in studio with us. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Engineer is Danny Bringer, and we get online support from David Mark. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns, Leslie Chang, Kathy Shield, Hannah Kingsley Ma, Charlie Zaharov, Eric Nygaard, and Caitlin Dakin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.